This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, conversation with Connecticut's two top lawmakers, Senate President Don Williams and House Speaker Brendan Sharkey. Coming up in a bit, Speaker Sharkey takes a bite out of our current tax models. But first, Senator Williams has announced his retirement after 20 years in the legislature after this session ends. We talked last week about his tenure, which included the aftermath of the scandal that sent Governor John Rowland to jail, and about his testimony over proposed legislation that would limit access to public records. Don Williams, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
There's a lot of issues that I want to talk to you about, but first I want to talk to you about the fact that you are leaving the Senate. You decided to retire from your position, and you made that announcement sort of midstream here, not at the end of the session, but you told people about it a while back. Why did you decide to step away from this job?
Well, you know, I've been in the Senate for 22 years overall. It will be 10 and a half years as president of the Senate at the end of my term. And I felt that this was the right time to challenge myself in some other ways. And at the same time, I have to admit that I've been so fortunate to have had this opportunity. It's been tremendously enjoyable to work with my colleagues at the Capitol, my staff, people on both sides of the aisle, and then to work on policy issues, some significant issues over that time.
What's a frustration? What's something you really wanted to get accomplished that you never did during the time that you were in the Senate?
You know, I wish I could tell you that there's this, you know, very significant issue that I haven't had a chance to satisfactorily work on. But I really don't have, for better or worse, a major frustration or a significant regret. I've had the privilege of being able to get out there on the issues, work with my colleagues, work on issues like I just mentioned, the Community Investment Act, school nutrition bill. You know, back in the mid part of the last decade, before folks were talking about school nutrition and the obesity crisis as far as children were concerned, on some environmental issues, you know, going back to the Sooty Six and reducing the sulfur dioxide emissions, and more recently the GMO labeling bill last session. And then, of course, I think what could have been a source of frustration in the wake of the terrible tragedy at Sandy Hook, deciding whether we would be able to respond in an effective way or even a bipartisan way as a legislature. And again, working with my colleagues in the House and the Senate to put together a bipartisan process and have a substantial bipartisan final product.
We're talking with Don Williams, the outgoing Senate president here on Where We Live, getting a chance to talk to him before he leaves this job, but also talk about some of the things that he has done while Senate president, and talk about a few issues that are important. I was going to wait for a while, but maybe we can dive into this now. You talk about the legislature's reaction to the terrible events at Sandy Hook, and there are a number of things that lawmakers were trying to tackle at once, and they had to do with mental health, and they had to do with guns. But for us here in the press, one of the things that happened that maybe wasn't such a great outcome was a real big change around our freedom of information laws. After this happened, there was certainly a lot of outcry from the families and other victims who said they didn't want any images or 911 calls from this event to end up in the news. And so the legislature passed some laws very quickly and without a whole lot of public debate, which quite substantially altered our freedom of information laws. And I know that's something that's been debated in a task force throughout the course of a year. I know it's something that is in legislation right now. I'm going to ask you about what you've said about this publicly in just a moment, but I guess I'm wondering if you can take us through the process that you were part of that got us from some folks very much being concerned about the images that might come out of Sandy Hook to a legal change that essentially shielded from public view crime scene photographs from any crime for this entire year.
That's a great question, John, because it actually gives me a chance to delve into that and to clear up, I think, what some are some misconceptions about what we did last year. The parents of the children who were killed, who were murdered at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, were very concerned about the possibility of official photographs, whether they were autopsy photographs, whether they were crime scene photos of children deceased, somehow coming into the public through the internet or other sources. And so they came to us looking for some protection from that. The legislation that we wound up passing does two things. It does two things that permanently change the law. One is to protect the identity of minor witnesses, which I think a lot of people thought was already protected, one of the numerous protections that are already in the statutes. There wasn't a lot of controversy about that. The second thing that it does, it protects the images potentially protects the images of homicide victims. Again, it has to be an official photograph, an autopsy picture, or a picture. Could be at the crime scene, but of the victim, of the deceased victim of a homicide, but only in the event that it is an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. There has been some discussion that this applies to all crimes. That's not true. Just homicides, or all crime scene pictures. Again, not true. It's got to be a picture just of the deceased victim of a homicide, and only in the event of an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. And what is the test for that in Connecticut? The test is something called the Perkins case, a state Supreme Court case, that says in order to be an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, two things have to be true. One, there must be no legitimate public interest. And in point of fact, most homicide cases will involve a legitimate point of personal public interest. And case law in other jurisdictions has upheld that. And then secondly, it also has to be a shock to a reasonable person. So what we thought would be cases that would fall under that, quite frankly, would be cases, pictures, official pictures, autopsy or otherwise, of deceased children, because there is a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals federal court case, the Marsh case, which says that under the Constitution, under the constitutional right to privacy that's been developed by the courts over the years, that a parent has the right to have protection against an image of that parent's deceased child, an official photograph of a deceased child, from being released. So that's the federal case law on that. I think a lot of folks sort of thought that there were other crime scene evidence that would be suppressed, other photographs, other crimes beyond homicide that were somehow caught up in this law. That's simply not the case. Now, there was another aspect of the law that for a temporary period of time, for 1 year, said that if there were audio tapes describing the deceased, and this was again designed for Sandy Hook, that identified specifically a deceased victim, that could be withheld. It turned out that no such tapes, people feared that those tapes existed. No such tapes did exist. It did not pertain to 911 cases. And as you know, the 911 tapes from Sandy Hook were released. And in point of fact, we found out important information about the quality of the response of first responders, and also the effectiveness of the response by staff within the schools. So that's what we did last year.
Now, sure. But quickly, just to get back to last year, that they were released after a ruling from a judge, correct?
That's correct, because I believe an official was withholding them and improperly withholding them. There was nothing in our law that said you have the right to withhold those 911 tapes. And there was nothing in what we passed last year. As a matter of fact, that was something that I was very concerned about. There was a suggestion that 911 tapes should be withheld, and I fought very hard against that, and that was not in the law.
So before we move forward to the bill that is out there now and the one that you've spoken about, one of the other things that I want to make sure we get as much clarity on as possible is the process. Indeed, this law last year was passed without very much, if any, public debate beforehand. I'm wondering if you can walk us through the process of how this came from being a proposed bill to becoming law without public hearings.
Oftentimes, you'll have issues that arise mid-session after the committee process has shut down, and that would mean the public hearing process, but before the end of our session. And there's the opportunity to amend bills, and to bring up additional issues that are raised during the course of a session, but after there's a public hearing. It's something that we do not prefer to do. It's certainly not best practices, but it is something that does occur. And in the middle of the session, last session, after we had passed the gun violence prevention bill concerning also mental health and school security issues, some parents reported that they were being harassed, that folks were calling them, that they were emailing them, that they were showing them offensive images, and they were afraid that if images of their deceased children became available, that they could be used as weapons to torment the parents. And so we listened to the parents, and we tried to fashion something that would provide some protection. And again, based on federal court law that says there is a right to privacy on behalf of a parent as to that parent's child, craft something that would address that concern.
We're talking with Don Williams, the state Senate president, here on Where We Live. So now let's fast forward to the legislation that has come out of a task force that was created. And maybe we can talk a little bit about the task force that did work on this all throughout the year. The expectation was that they would take a look at this issue very closely, that they would have in some ways the public hearing that we didn't have before the law got passed, and make some recommendations that would then turn into a piece of legislation. The legislation as proposed is legislation that you've come out very strongly against. What does this legislation do, and why did you testify against it?
Well, it addresses information about witnesses. And it also addresses issues related to more information about crimes, such as 911 calls. And on the issue of witnesses, I mentioned that last year we protected the identity of witnesses who are minors. And again, a lot of folks thought that was already part of the law. And there are other parts of our law that protect the identity of witnesses where they have been intimidated, where they have been threatened, where the release of the name of a witness might jeopardize an ongoing investigation. There are numerous exceptions that have been incorporated into our law for specific reasons over the years. This year, the task force came out and said that we should protect and not release information about witnesses in vast categories of our criminal law. For example, in all substance abuse cases, in all sexual assault cases, in all crimes of violence, without any justification, such as the endangerment of the witness, possibility of jeopardizing the integrity of an investigation. So we have never seen anything this broad or this sweeping before. And as I pointed out to my colleagues, I said, you know, we have a tradition in this country of folks who have been wrongfully convicted, and we find this out later. And the way we find it out is because law students or journalists or concerned citizens investigate the case, they look at the evidence, they re-interview witnesses who then often recant their testimony. But they could not do that without being able to revisit the particular case, talk to witnesses. And this type of effort has literally saved folks in other states from the death penalty, and we've seen other people who've been sentenced to long terms in jail who've been freed as a result. So for that reason, and for a whole lot of other reasons involving transparency in our criminal justice system, I just thought this was a completely unwarranted overreach. And there was also the attempt to say no access to 911 calls, except that you could appeal that to the Freedom of Information Commission. And of course, an appeal would take at minimum weeks, possibly months. And then if there was an appeal from that ruling to the Superior Court, that could take years. And we know that the importance of something like a 911 tape is at the time of that controversy. That's when folks want to know about that. That's when we could learn something about it. And we might learn something that could help influence reforms to our criminal justice system. I would argue that the Trayvon Martin case in Florida would not have become the national case that it did without the release of the 911 tapes that brought literally national attention to a case where the prosecution had not acted. They had not filed charges, and the national media wasn't paying attention. And it opened the door to a necessary conversation about racial profiling and the Stand Your Ground laws.
When it comes to either the 911 calls or images that are officially taken at crime scenes that depict a homicide victim, one of the concerns of many in the press is not that these would not be under whether it's current law or whether it's a proposed law, that they would not be eventually made available to us, but that the presumption would be that we would have to ask law enforcement, and law enforcement would make determinations on a case-by-case basis, which then we would have to fight an appeal, which could take quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money, and may not ever allow us to be able to see the things that we might need to do that very kind of investigation that you just talked about, to actually dig into things in a way that might help to break a case or to keep someone from going to jail who shouldn't be going to jail. Do you think, Don Williams, that we're heading in the wrong direction when it comes to the ability of the press and citizens to get publicly available information, even if it's information that may be troubling to some?
Yes, absolutely. If you're looking at taking a broad brush, as this legislation does this year, and completely removing information about witnesses in probably 75% of our criminal cases that go to trial, and then forcing the news media to have to go to the Freedom of Information Commission when it comes to 911 calls, I think that's the wrong direction.
So how do we fix this? Because I think one of the things that has been put into place here is because of the legislation that was passed last year and because of the recommendations of the task force that came out of that, whether or not this bill gets passed, it seems as though we have moved away from the freedoms of information that we had prior to December of 2012. In your estimation, as you're outgoing here, how would you fix what we have right now?
By rejecting this legislation in total this session. I don't think any of this legislation is necessary. I do believe that when you look at last year's legislation, that you're right that there were some additional protections, but I think those protections were narrow and justifiable in terms of being able to protect particularly images of deceased children, victims of murder, when that is the parent's preference. But when you talk about what they're trying to do this year, again, protecting or eliminating the possibility without appeal of getting information about witnesses in entire categories of crime, or denying media the access to the 911 calls, that is not, that's counterproductive to transparency in our judicial system.
We're talking with outgoing Senate President Don Williams. When we come back from our break, we'll continue our conversation about corruption at the state capitol. Later on, we'll talk with House Speaker Brendan Sharkey about his idea for a reverse pilot program. We'll find out what that means. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, two conversations with Connecticut's top two lawmakers. Coming up later, Brendan Sharkey wants nonprofits to pay their fair share of taxes. Right now, though, I'm talking with Don Williams, outgoing Senate president. He'll step down when the session is over. A big part of his tenure was dealing with the reality and aftermath of the John Rowland corruption scandal. The legislature and Rowland's successor, Jody Rell, pushed through comprehensive campaign finance laws after that. But those laws have been changed and, some would say, eroded in the last few years. I asked first about the perception of the state as corrupt, following that and several other corruption investigations.
Well, I'm not sure that we can entirely change it. You know, after I announced that I was leaving politics, on one social media response to it was, oh, we're going to miss you, Don, especially in these incredibly corrupt times. And I thought to myself, you know, I like the fact that the person's going to miss that I'll be gone. But in point of fact, in my career, and I've served 22 years in the state Senate, I've worked with a lot of different Democrats and Republicans. And virtually everyone that I've worked with over that time has been a person of integrity, a person who's dedicated to public service. I may not agree with them on issues, but I can, at the end of the day, say, you know, I respect where they're coming from, and I know that they believe they're coming from that point of view for the right reasons. Unfortunately, there are bad apples in every barrel, and it's true in politics, it's true in law, in medicine, it's sure true on Wall Street. Almost anywhere you look, you can find incidents of folks who do the wrong thing instead of the right thing. And for the most part, that's the exception, and that's true in politics as well. So we've seen folks succumb to weakness in politics, again, as in other sectors and other realms. You mentioned Governor Roland and others. But I wouldn't want people to think and go away with the thought of that comment that I mentioned, that, oh, gee, it's all corrupt, or that it's worse now than it's ever been. We have more transparency now than we've ever had American politics. I think that the potential for corruption was much greater 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't always be vigilant right now. But I want to tell folks that in my experience, that has been the rare exception. And the vast majority of Democrats and Republicans are in it for the right reasons. And they're in it because they're committed to public service.
A keystone of what happened at the legislature, though, after John Roland went to prison, and is spearheaded in part by former Governor Jody Rell, was campaign finance legislation that was, in its way, the first of its kind. And many observers have looked at the campaign finance laws in the state and said that since those landmark laws were passed, that indeed they've been weakened. They've been changed in a way that sort of makes them less effective than they were when they were originally instituted. How do you see that? Do you think that in terms of campaign finance in the state, that we're moving in the wrong direction?
No, I disagree with that. The fundamental piece of campaign finance reform was public financing, and that has changed things for the better. There's a difference between corruption and undue influence, although I think some folks might say that sounds like a pretty fine distinction. But at the federal level and in states that the vast majority of states where there's not public financing and they're reliant upon private contributions— there's nothing illegal about folks contributing to campaigns expecting to influence the process. And some would argue that's why they contribute vast amounts, because they expect to have more access. They expect to have their views given more sway. And there's nothing technically wrong with that process. That is a legal process. But when we enacted public financing, we knew that there was undue influence, even within the legal context of a process where people give you campaign contributions. And in recent years, we have made some changes, making it possible to raise money, whether it's through the state party, through certain leadership political action committees, to raise additional funds. Quite frankly, that has been in response to Citizens United. I think that the greatest threat right now is not through minor modifications that allow us to contribute possibly a few extra $1,000 to candidates under our existing system. It's the Citizens United decision that allows unnamed donors to come into our state and spend as much money as they want, $10,000, $50,000, $1 million, to influence one race or many races with vicious negative attack ads that we've seen. And so we have tried to figure out how can we help preserve this system of public financing so that people don't just simply opt out of it, as has happened at the national level in the presidential races.
But is allowing, say, more money to flow through the state parties really the way to tackle the Citizens United problem?
In the absence of a better idea, absolutely. Keeping people competitive, giving them the chance to respond to these vicious negative attacks that will come from who knows where you can be outspent two times, three times, four times to one. But the important thing about public financing is that we have set it at a threshold level that folks can get a message across. And we know that in a campaign, you can be outspent. And you can withstand those vicious negative attacks if you have enough resources, and we have this through public financing, to get out your core message.
Don Williams, what are you going to do next?
John, that's a great question. I have to say, I didn't go about this in a way that I think most of us would prefer, which is to have your next job all lined up. I wanted to make this decision to share this with my caucus before I then took the next step and decided what would be next for me. So I will be testing the waters when we're done with our business at the Capitol. My background, John, if you're interested, is in obviously government. It's in law. It's in journalism, education. So I'm kind of excited. There's anxiety, of course, when you're moving on and you're saying, now I'm going to do something else. But there's excitement, too, because I think for all of us, there can and should be a second and third acts.
Well, I know a little bit about your resume, and that includes some time in radio. Ever think about getting back into that? I hear that it's, you know, they give out afternoon shows to people who used to be in politics.
Well, I haven't committed any felonies, John, so I'm not sure that I'd be able to get.
You're not qualified?
I'm not qualified for that.
Well, Don Williams, great to speak with you. I'm sure we'll be talking again before this term is out, but I do very much appreciate your time, and thanks very much for sharing some of it here on Where We Live.
Thank you, John.
Coming up, we'll talk with House Speaker Brendan Charkey about his idea for a reverse pilot program. That's pilot as in payment in lieu of taxes. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, there's an ongoing debate in the state capitol over Connecticut's family courts. On one side, angry parents expressing their discontent with legal costs and with case outcomes. On the other hand, it's child custody professionals fighting to defend their work in the system. It's an issue that prompted the Judiciary Committee to hold a public hearing later today. On our program, we'll find out what happened, what's causing contention in the family court system. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Brendan Charkey's made his name at the state capitol, leading a charge for regionalization, incentivizing 169 towns and cities to work across borders to try to save money and cut down on the reliance on property taxes. Now he's House Speaker, and his newest proposal might be the boldest yet. It's about pilot money, a wonky name for payment in lieu of taxes, the money that towns get back from the state to replace revenue they don't get from the big nonprofit schools and hospitals within their borders. Now, in some communities, that lost revenue is a really big deal. Charkey says the towns help support nonprofits that serve an entire region, while those nonprofits often pay big salaries and expand their missions without paying taxes. His new idea is called Reverse Pilot, which he'll explain. It would change the way tax dollars flow. We spoke last week just before he testified about his plan in front of the Planning and Development Committee at the Capitol. Brendan Charkey, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Before we get into this reverse pilot idea that I want to understand a little bit better that you've proposed, give me a sense of where we are right now with your longstanding goal of having different municipalities collaborate in various ways, collaborations that in the past maybe didn't happen so much. How far have we gotten, do you think?
We've come a long way, frankly. We've broken down a lot of the barriers that were created legally between towns and boards of ed working together. And I also think we've broken down a lot of the psychological barriers, if you will, that have prevented or caused towns and local residents to view their neighbors as somewhat in a somewhat adversarial position. And I think, frankly, a lot of that has to do with education, but more of it has to do with the economies. I think local property taxpayers are getting the fact that, unlike the rest of the world in the 21st century, where downsizing and efficiencies are the order of the day, they look at their local property tax bills and say, and look at their local towns and say, wow, why do we have separate public works departments, and why do we pay for back office operations, and we don't share these services with other towns? I think they make the connection between the size of their property tax bill and what those inefficiencies actually cost.
Okay, so what are the hard things? What are the things that we haven't yet gotten to when it comes to municipal collaboration that might take some doing or might just take a entirely different sort of mindset?
Education.
Yeah.
The education side of the local tax ledger has, because of the way we do taxation at the local level, by lumping both the municipal expense and the Board of Education's expense into one tax bill, and that goes out to taxpayers and families locally. Education, unlike just about any other state in the country, is somewhat insulated from the taxpayer, if you will, because they don't argue their case for what their budget should be directly to the taxpayers. They argue their case to the local legislative body of the town, either the Board of Selectmen or the town council. And they lobby for their interests, appropriately so, for funding. But the taxpayers are kind of one step removed from the Board of Education. The leadership is to the people who actually spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
So and I think that this is a bit of a problem because we certainly want to maintain the sense of local control over education I think people value in Connecticut. And I think that that in general has stood us well in terms of the quality of the education we get at the local level. But I think there are efficiencies that we can realize on the education side. I think the town side of the budget for the last 20 years, since I was a municipal CAO, the town side of the budget has always been squeezed and cut and tightened to make more room available for education, for the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that I think, as I say, education has not had that same level of scrutiny as to the kinds of cost savings that they might realize. And I think that there's a lot of room on the education side of the ledger at the local level that could be realized if we can segregate the tax bill, you know, make the Board of Ed a little bit more accountable directly to the taxpayers, and then open our minds a little bit to some of those other options for cost savings that could be realized without impairing the quality of the schools.
We're talking with House Speaker Brendan Sharkey, and we're talking about some efforts that he's made over the years to get communities across Connecticut working more closely together. We're going to turn to a new program or a new idea that he's floated. It's called Reverse Pilot. And first of all, before we understand what a reverse pilot is, I have to ask you to explain to our listeners what pilot is. This is payment in lieu of taxes. What is this?
We have currently a system that compensates towns and cities for lost revenue that they realize as a result of the tax exemption that we bestow on colleges and hospitals as nonprofit institutions. So what happens is these institutions locally are assessed, and the taxes that are not collected because of the tax exemption, the towns apply to the state for reimbursement of those lost taxes in the form of a pilot payment. Now, originally when the program was started, it was supposed to be at about 70% of the lost revenue the towns would get back.
You weren't going to get all the money back from the state that you lost, but you were going to get, let's say, three-quarters of it,
right,
or thereabouts.
Right. And over the years, we've winnowed that pot, that state pot, down to what is now at about one-third of the actual revenue that would be received otherwise. So annually, we go through this tug-of-war back and forth where towns and cities, the families get frustrated about the fact that they're shouldering the burden for the subsidy that's provided to the colleges or hospital that may be in their community. And the towns come to the state and say, increase pilot. But it's always a zero-sum game because there's a finite amount of money in the pot. So if one college decides to expand and buy up new properties in town, that shrinks the amount of money that's available to every other town that has one of these institutions. And so it's kind of a backward way, in my opinion, of how to actually subsidize the tax exemption that these institutions enjoy.
So one of the things that I was struck by when we spoke the other day and I listened to you roll this out, talk to it in front of this group talking about municipal collaboration, is you use some terminology about gone are the days of looking at the hospital or the university in a community as this do-gooder institution. Those words that you used. And you just used the term shouldering the burden to take on the fact that these institutions are in your community. I would say, though, that for many people who live in communities across the state, if you have a university, you have a hospital in your town, you see that inherently as a good. I mean,
if I have a hospital with an emergency room in my town, I frankly value that probably even a little bit more than I do a lot of the services the town provides, because they're there providing services to me every day. Can you talk a little bit about that balance of how much we should have to shoulder the burden, as you say, for these institutions in our community, and how much we should really realize that these institutions are a big part of the communities where they are?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think the getting into a little bit of the specifics about what my proposal, the notion of a reverse pilot is to say that these institutions, rather than being exempt and then the towns and have to apply to the state with their hands out looking for it to be reimbursed, instead what would happen is that the institutions would pay taxes and they could apply to the state for reimbursement of the taxes that they actually pay. And a key provision of all this is that the institutions and the towns can negotiate. Unlike any other taxpayer in the state, these institutions would be able to negotiate what their actual tax bill would be. And as part of that negotiation, they would be making the argument that you make. We are a substantial contributor to your economy. We provide jobs to your town. We provide these other services and community benefits. So therefore, we shouldn't be paying the full amount of what we would otherwise be assessed. We should be something less. And it's that they'll still get reimbursed from the pilot fund for what they pay to the town.
But we're not sure how much that reimbursement from the state would be.
Well, we would keep the same level of funding that we currently have.
So in the 33 cents on a dollar range.
Right, in that range. And then whatever incremental increase of that amount is what these institutions would actually have to pay. And that's a subject to this negotiation. And of course, those arguments that you're making would be, you know, critical arguments to be made for why they should be paying less than the full amount that they would otherwise.
But
the other point of this, though, is that this brings out the problem of the property tax in Connecticut, right?
Yes.
If you host these facilities in your town, in some way, yes, you get benefits from it, but you also, financially speaking, draw the short straw, because everyone in the region benefits from the college and the hospital being somewhere locally. Everyone in the region benefits from the economic spinoff, from the jobs that are created, but not everybody in the region pays the cost of hosting it.
And that's one of the things I wanted to get to, that I want to understand about your proposal, because everything that we talked about in the first bit of our conversation is something you've been working on so much for years, even before you were speaker, was this idea of municipal collaboration. If each and every community has to go and negotiate individually with their institutions in order to get the best possible deal for the town and for the institution, it seems as though in many ways we're moving away from that municipal collaboration model, and we're saying, towns, you're on your own. You got to negotiate with your hospital, or you got to negotiate with your university or other big institution on your own, without taking into account that municipal collaboration piece, which really does say everyone benefits from having a hospital in town X in all the surrounding towns.
Right. Well, until we create some kind of a regional taxation, property tax system, which I've also advocated for, and we've created laws to do that if towns are willing to do that. Until that exists, the reality is that right now, under the current system, towns are and local families and taxpayers are subsidizing the cost of these institutions existing in their towns. They have no leverage in this discussion because the towns are exempt. They have to go hat in hand to the state asking for reimbursements, begging the state for reimbursements to help keep local property taxes low. The value of this is that we've now created more leverage for these host communities so that they will be ensured that they will get the tax revenue that they would otherwise not receive. But it's really a question of these institutions making the case for why they should be paying less. To your point about regionalizing that cost, in other states, the nonprofit status of the college or hospital is actually borne by a much larger population and universe of taxpayers, because typically in other states, taxes are charged on a county basis, not on a town-by-town basis. So if you're the town that happens to have the hospital or the college, great. You know, that is a real windfall for you, and it's terrific that it's local and all that. But the cost of hosting that facility, the police, the fire, all those other expenses are borne by a full county full of people, a much bigger universe.
So how could we use a plan like yours to get more at that system? Because, again, I see what you're getting at. The weakness I see in it is it sets up 169 little individual leverages, which then we have to, again, be a state in which we're split apart so that each community is negotiating their own deal. And I can see a number of, let's just say, pitfalls to that, including institutions saying, well, I was going to build a new cancer center for my hospital in your town, but you know what? Shelton next door has got a much better deal for me, so I'll go over there. It sets up some of this town-by-town competition in a way that's maybe not as healthy as regionalizing it.
Well, I agree. But again, until we can actually get to the notion of regional taxation,
I guess that's my question. Can we use an almost crisis like this, a crisis in the tax base that we have for these communities? If we're going to upset the apple cart and try something this new, couldn't we try something a little newer and start to get at that regional?
I'd love to do that. But yeah. The practical reality is that, politically speaking, getting a regional tax system and a tax subsidy from surrounding towns for these institutions that provide regional benefits is a lot more difficult to accomplish. And it's certainly a goal of mine to be able to do that. And as I say, I've championed bills that create exactly this kind of setup where my concern was how towns, for example, compete with each other for economic development opportunities, the new corporate headquarters or the new mall. We've created already, it's on the books, towns can collaborate regionally to agree that they're not going to compete with each other for new economic development opportunities. They're going to agree that the host community will get a big portion of the property taxes generated, but the host community will share that revenue with the communities around them. That was created about 4 years ago, and to date, no town has taken up that mantle or has actually pursued that. We have a lot of entrenched habits. And the problem is right now that many of the towns that are hosting these facilities are really suffering financially, and their local taxpayers are getting annoyed. You're right. We should be going to a bigger picture.
And I'm just thinking through this with you because one of the things that's intriguing about the idea is by changing this and by making the institutions then come hat in hand to the state, then the state, you're saying, we're going to keep the funding at around the same that we're giving the towns right now, 33%. But now maybe the state has a little bit more of a hammer in all this. If you want regional operators, a hospital, say, or a university, to act in a, we'll call it, smart growth way, mm-hmm. building their new satellite campus or their new satellite center in a town that makes sense from a regional standpoint, it seems as though this could be a way that you could incentivize certain behavior, both on the part of the towns and also on the part of the institution.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, first of all, fundamentally, the proposal spreads the burden, spreads the cost of hosting these facilities out throughout the state. But you're right. If we were to institute this proposal, the state plays a bigger role from a policy standpoint in what they want to see and what they want to encourage and what makes sense in terms of spreading the wealth to a certain degree.
Right. Another thing that you mentioned the other day is there's a reality, certainly in the healthcare field, that more and more of these hospitals are looking at becoming for-profit anyway. Some of the nonprofits, some of the big institutions that are off the tax rolls in towns are already looking to be for-profit. It seems as though they kind of see the writing on the wall.
Yeah, they do. For example, there's a lot of discussion around about the fact that an out-of-state for-profit institution may be taking over Waterbury Hospital and a few others around the state. Under current law, if Waterbury Hospital goes to a for-profit, the city of Waterbury gets a windfall because that facility will be taxed. Now, where's the equity in that? So that Waterbury gets the windfall, but Torrington, which continues to host a nonprofit hospital, does not. So we're in a new world right now, particularly with regard to hospitals, where the distinctions, I think, between for and nonprofits are actually starting to get blurred. And this is probably a good time to consider this kind of an approach so that everyone is recognizing that these institutions are not your mom and dad's nonprofits anymore. These are major corporations paying major salaries to their executives, major employment centers. And the only thing that distinguishes them from their corporate counterparts in their communities is the fact that they don't pay taxes.
Quinnipiac University is a good example in Hamden. It's a university that has just grown and grown and grown over the years, not just on their campus, but in satellite campuses. And I was just there the other day doing a piece that we aired on Friday about the Hunger Museum, which is right there on Whitney Avenue.
Right.
Almost every property, it seems, has a Quinnipiac University sign in front of it.
All of them are off the tax rolls.
And all of them are off the tax rolls. I'm Quinnipiac University. I'm saying, but look, before I was there, there weren't restaurants in Whitney Avenue. There wasn't the economic activity that there is now. Why should I, having invested all this money in the town of Hamden, why should I have to pay more to the state and the city? Look at all I've done already.
Well, I think everybody, I think, in Hamden, for example, recognizes the value that Quinnipiac brings in terms of employment and in terms of economic activity. First of all, that activity is not benefiting Hamden exclusively. And some would argue that maybe the investments that Quinnipiac is making in acquiring properties is not really in the best interest of the town. They're purchasing a number of single-family homes to house students. Again, whole neighborhoods are being purchased by Quinnipiac, and those properties are coming off the tax rolls. But there's also a cost associated with hosting them. There's there were several incidents back in January with parties and other emergency services that are consistently needed to actually be able to host these facilities in town. Quinnipiac purchased some of that from the town in terms of off-duty police, but primarily that's a cost that's borne by the families of Hamden. And there's a level of frustration that has built in our community in Hamden about whether this growth is necessarily in the best interests of the town. It's great that they're there, but there's also a big downside. And, I'm reminded of a comment that was made by one of the executives from Quinnipiac when this idea was first floated in response to a letter that our local council president sent to me expressing his frustration. And he said, well, Quinnipiac, or the letter should be addressed to Speaker Boehner in Washington, not Speaker Sharkey in Hartford, because we're tax exempt. We're federally tax exempt, and that entitles us to a tax exemption on property taxes, which, of course, is not true. Legally, they have their tax exemption by virtue of state statute, not by their federal tax ID status. And I think that demonstrated a bit of a disconnect between that institution and their sense of what they owe to the community, what their commitment is and what their obligation is to work with the town to help the families of Hamden also afford their presence in the community.
A very last thing for you. Among the comments that you made, you said that 2015 is maybe the year, not an election year, not 2014, but 2015 is maybe the year in which you try to move this proposal forward. Amongst the things that you said at the time...
I should correct you.
Yeah.
We're planning on doing it this year in 2014, this particular proposal.
But you did mention 2015 is the year for this. And so that sounded to me an awful lot like 2014 wasn't going to get a whole heck of a lot done.
I'm planning on moving this. There is tremendous momentum for this concept.
Okay.
Around the state. I've talked to three or four different editorial boards already about
it. House Speaker Brendan Truckee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. Yeah, enjoyed it.
You can find all our recent Where We Live shows on our website, WNPR.org. You can also find out what's coming up throughout this week. You can follow us and get involved in the show at Where We Live on Facebook and Twitter. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.